Safety, dependability, and power. Chevy Silverado isn't happy unless the work is hard and the day is long. No wonder Silverado is America's number one best-selling retail pickup truck. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and put a Silverado in your toolbox.
And we have a new president. Good afternoon. This is Anna DeBlantis, President Joe Biden. I just checked, and the POTUS account on Twitter, back up and running. Remember, it was shut down. President Trump was not allowed to tweet any longer. President Biden's first tweet here as president, I'll read it to you. No time to waste when it comes to tackling the crises we face. That's why today I'm heading to the Oval Office to get right to work delivering bold action and immediate relief for American families. Kind of get the sense there that President Biden will be using Twitter in a slightly different way than President Trump did. But let's get to Joe Biden's speech. What did you think of the speech? Two things that I always feel are most meaningful, most important for any president's inaugural speech are, number one, the tone, and number two, the words being second. I felt his tone was one of calm, and he was very direct. He was forceful at times. His words largely about unity, promising to govern for all Americans. I will fight for as hard for those who did not support me as for those who did. Now the hard part, of course, turn that rhetoric into reality. Let's talk about the speech and the reality ahead. Michael Golden, he lives in reality, I think. Michael, how are you?
I'm good, Anna. How are you on this crazy day?
Absolutely. Lots going on. I should say you're a local political analyst. You wrote Unlock Congress, the book, and you've had some really thought-provoking opinion pieces in national media recently. One of them, advice to Biden on what he should say in his speech. I'm wondering, did he listen? Did he listen to you, Michael? Did he get it right?
Well, he didn't listen to me, but he said something along the lines of what I was hoping that he would say. I mean, I think everybody was expecting him through his past and just through who he is and through the moment of at this moment in time to be something of a unifier. And you know, I wrote this down, Anna. He wrote somewhere in the middle there where he was addressing folks who didn't vote for him, which is what I wrote about. He said, quote, "We must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We can do this if we open our souls instead of hardening our hearts. We show a little tolerance and humility," end quote. And it reminded me of that scene in the movie Lincoln when Daniel Day-Lewis, toward the end of the Civil War, said to his opponents, "Shall we end this bleeding now?" Not as dramatic as the Civil War, but when we look back 50 years at this moment, I think it's sort of like us, Anna, looking back 50 years at 1968, 52 years, actually, when I was 1 year old, and I never got to experience that. But that was the last time this country was in this kind of tumult. And whether you're on the right or the left, no matter how you felt about the last 4 years, I think that he did a pretty good job today, pretty good job of trying to speak to everyone. And that is not easy in 2021.
No, there's no doubt about it. It is probably going to be the single most difficult challenge of his presidency, at least that we can see right now, getting through a pandemic and the economy and the job situation. But a divisive country is something that a president's tone can really, and his actions, more importantly, can have a real impact on.
For sure. For sure. And I heard you talk about that earlier in tone. And look, that's what Joe Biden actually is best at. He's not the most exciting speaker. He doesn't know how to punch a word or phrase in the same dramatic way that Ronald Reagan did or Bill Clinton did or Barack Obama did. He's steadier. But he does, he does put a lot of thought into putting this stuff into perspective. And he also knows that the words he's going to speak on a day like today, they're going to be seen through the lens of history and not just through the television drama of the moment. That's not his overwhelming strength. And I think that he did that about as well as he could. And look, the as they say, the actions speak louder than words, right? How he's going to govern in the next 100 days, in the next year, is going to matter a lot. And I think he's going to listen to Republicans as much as any Democrat could who beat Trump and became president. And at the right time, when there's no more negotiation to be had, And there's a stalemate, he'll drop the hammer and do what he has to do, which will be a unique thing for him, Anna, because he's been a conciliator for 50 years, even as vice president. And now he's got a different job.
interesting. Not Natasha Korecki. I don't know if you're familiar with her work. She's a former Sun Times reporter, and she had this great piece in Politico. It was sort of the behind the scenes piece of all this, and talking about how writing a speech for Joe Biden can be hell, and that was before the inaugural, saying that, you know, here's a guy who rehearses and tells you, I'd never say that, get that out of there. And they said, well, we took this from one of the things you said already. I mean, like, he just, you know, he's very,
I've experienced that, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, you have. You've gotten that sort of message. Hey, what are you writing this for, huh?
For sure, for sure. People forget what they say. Look, this is heady stuff. When you're sure. thinking about writing 20 minutes, just 20 minutes, and it's going to be remembered in history, not just as an inaugural, but an inaugural at a time like this. You'll drive yourself nuts if you're the speaker. I mean, he's been in government for 50 years. He's seen more than most of us would even remember. So I did read that. I did read Natasha's article, and it was great.
And it's not
that far off other presidents that I've read about. You know,
they
have reliable staff that know their voice, and at the same time, they want to get it just right. Bill Clinton would do this right up until the State of the Union. And one time, actually, it went off the prompter, and they screwed up the computer, and he sort of riffed live for 20 minutes, showed you how brilliant he was. But I think at the end of the day today, even though they were working on this morning, they got him to say what he wanted to say, whether you know, not everyone's going to agree or disagree with it, but I think that he look, he struck as conciliatory a tone, as you said earlier, Anna, as somebody who could strike after the last 5 years. That's
sure.
what I really think.
Well, it's the other part that she pointed out sort of references what you said. He's well aware that this is the most important inaugural speech since Lincoln. Joe Biden, the boy who grew up talking with a stutter, will deliver an inaugural address that carries more weight than any of the speeches he has obsessed over in the past. So I think it all did come together, and we'll be talking about this on the show throughout, too. Kind of where do you go from here? So that's the speech. That's setting the tone of what you want to accomplish, of what you think the priorities are. And now where do you go from here?
Yeah, where you go from here, right. It's look, I think what I was writing about and what President Biden spoke to, and by the way, most presidents do this in the inaugural. They know they've won, they know they got the votes, but they also know it's a split country. And especially in our system, especially in our three-branch system, and even though the Democrats barely hold the power on Capitol Hill, you know, it's a 60-vote rule still, which I've argued against, but it's not that simple to get all this stuff done. So to go from here, you know, Joe Biden's not a far-left liberal to begin with, no matter what anybody says about him, if you just look at 50 years. However, he's got a lot of pressure on him coming from the left because he won and he beat some of those people that were further left of him in the presidential primary. So he by nature, is somebody who likes to compromise and make deals. And I think that that's the positive thing. For people who want to see the government do things that are going to help the overwhelming majority of Americans, the good news is that he and Mitch McConnell are both institutionalists, and they've worked together, and they have a level of trust. And in Washington, trust is the currency by which anything gets done.
Yeah.
There's so much that doesn't get done because of mistrust. So those guys don't agree on most things philosophically, but they do know certain things have to be done. And if they can trust each other's word to answer your specific question about where do we go from here, it starts with those two, Anna. It starts with those two. Not the Democrats holding not the Speaker, not Chuck Schumer. It starts with McConnell and Biden. And they have a long history of getting things done together, even amidst their disagreements.
Well, there is a long road ahead, and it's the stuff you talk about all the time in your book, Unlock Congress. When you've unlocked Congress, let us know. But I'd also like you to call back and let us know, as we sort of move along here, how things are going. Michael Golden, thanks for joining this afternoon.
My pleasure, Anna. Thanks, and it's a new year starting today, actually, on January 20th. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk with Jason DeSanto here. He's a political speech writer, and I want to get his thoughts about what he just heard. He's also a senior lecturer at Northwestern University, Pritzker School of Law. Hey, Jason, how have you been?
Hey, Anna. Good to talk to you. How you been?
Yeah, you know, pretty good. I know you've been busy because we've been trying to get you on the show, and you're not always available. I assume it wasn't because you were writing Joe Biden's speech, but you've written a lot of political speeches in your career, and I know you have thoughts about it.
Yep, that's true on both counts. I do have some thoughts about it. I thought it was an excellent speech. both by the traditional measures of an inaugural address, but also just in terms of what it achieved for the day. And we can go into each one of those kind of metrics, but I thought overall it met the moment, and that's what you have to do on day one.
My whole soul is in this. That stands out. That's one of the headlines being produced in the newspapers and the online sites right now. People are saying that, you know, he talked about bringing unity to a wounded country. I think everyone sort of knew that's going to be his central message. That's what he said his theme will be. Did he convince people, do you think? I mean, you've got such a divided country. He's saying he's going to fight as hard for the folks who did not vote for him, and there are a lot of those, as he will for the people who did vote for him. How do you really get people to engage in that message when they didn't? And you've seen what of the events that have happened over the recent weeks, that it's sort of, does it fall on deaf ears? Is there any way to connect?
Yeah, I think that was the key message. And part of it starts with what you quoted there, Anna, which is my whole soul is in this. And that's kind of a quintessentially Joe Biden thing to say. And also in the speech, even using terms like folks, I mean, we ascribe those things to Joe Biden because that's who he is as a personality. So part of the way you convince people of things that sound intangible, that sound lofty, is to have credibility and to seem like you're yourself in delivering that speech. And I think that was a Joe Biden speech in all the good ways, not in the sometimes not so good ways. So I think that is helpful just for credibility's sake. And when we talk about unity, there's nothing unusual about unity in an inaugural address. In fact, that is one of the typical speech. The inaugural speech really does three different things, and you can look through time and whether they're Republicans or Democrats. These speeches generally do three things. One of them is they do try to unify the citizenry, to remind people that after a bitter election, we're one people, and that that is a symbolic act, it's a ritualistic act, and that the oath of office does that by order of the Constitution, but that the citizenry itself is reconstituted through language. And so in talking about unity, Biden was talking about what's commonly done in these speeches, but what was a little different about the way that he did it in this speech was he not only made it central, but he also made a little bit of an argument, I think, for what unity looks like. And I think that was a pretty realistic argument. So when we're thinking about what it's going to take for us to have the unity to act, he wasn't simply saying that this is something we can have just by calling it unity, that there's kind of a way of living where disagreement can't be disunion. And that we need to be able to stop the shouting. In some ways, that echoed Richard Nixon, strangely, in 1969. A little bit of tolerance, humility, treating people not as adversaries, but as neighbors. And I think a healthy and realistic recognition that it doesn't mean every single person is going to agree, nor does it mean that every single person who disagrees is going to believe in the American project. But I think one of the key phrases here was that enough of us in our history have to keep democracy moving forward. And I think that's what he's pitching it to, and that's his goal.
Anything you would have done differently had you written the speech? Something he said, should have said, maybe something he did say and he should have left out? Anything you'd say, you know what, this is what I do differently?
You know, I can't think of anything offhand that I would have done a little bit differently. And what I was really pleasantly surprised by in the speech was the range of the delivery of the speech. And I know that sounds somewhat stylistic and can sound technical, but it really makes a difference. It makes a difference in the way that people hear different parts of the speech. So in other words, when you want to sound soothing, it's more important to show than to tell. If you want to give a speech that's all about healing, you have to evidence that you have that within yourself. And you can't do that by shouting at people. And I thought there were some moments in there where he really slowed it down and spoke in a much slower tone, at a much slower rate, and in a much quieter way than I had seen him earlier during the campaign cycle. And I think that had a positive effect. You know, I think if you think about the audiences for this speech, I mean, I have to think about it in this way. If you voted for Biden, I think you felt a sense of catharsis. If you voted for Trump, you felt maybe you might get a hearing from Joe Biden. And if you're non-political, which a lot of people are, even the people who voted in this election, don't consider themselves fiercely political, I think maybe you felt like you might get a break from political chaos. And I think a lot of that came not just from the words, but from his demeanor.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. You know, you think of things like moments like Tom Cruise jumping on the couch with Oprah, how super excited he was that he was marrying Katie Holmes, I think it was, and it was just didn't match the like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. That just sounds disingenuous. And you're right. You do communicate a lot with your tone. That's why I pointed that out at the top. I think we're the tone was important. That sets the stage for what's to come, and who knows what's to come, Jason. I mean, frankly, it's he's got his work cut out for him, no doubt about it. But let me ask you this. Did I miss it? I never heard President Biden mention Donald Trump by name. I think he referenced him in sort of roundabout ways. And I know Donald Trump, President Trump, when he was outgoing and gave his farewell address, he also did not mention Joe Biden. He said the next administration. But that's absolutely a decision, right? You make that decision when you're writing this speech.
It is a choice. And I take it that the choice that that reflects is a kind of a measured approach, what we call a prudent approach that Biden has taken since election night. You know, we haven't seen a lot of Joe Biden. And I, you know, some people would say, well, that's, you know, he's hiding out in his basement. But I think we've seen him not only during the campaign, but then after the campaign in rather not somber, but I think sober tones and in a kind of restrained way and trying not to roil divisions. And I think even the mentioning of President Trump would probably have done that in a way that would have detracted from the transfer of power. And the peaceful transfer of power and a move to the future. And I think all of those things were signified by the setting and also the way that he referenced both history, but history that we're going to carry forward. And that's another part of inaugural addresses, is the idea of renewal. It was an interesting part of this speech where Biden, looking off from the West Balcony, and the first president to deliver from the West Balcony of the Capitol was Ronald Reagan. And when Reagan did that, he referenced many of the monuments, the Washington Monument and the Jefferson Memorial and the Lincoln Memorial, and what each of those of the founders and post-founders did for our history. And Biden really did that again today. And he kind of, in doing that, when a president does that in the inaugural, what they're really seeking is renewal of our values and traditions. And renewal is not about looking backwards. It's about referencing the past in order to move forward. And in that spirit, let's move forward. And we know that Trump is a divisive figure, and if we're going to start this new era, better to just start it. And I think that was the decision. I think it was a wise one.
Yeah. Just as we wrap things up here, Jason, tell me, who would you like to write a speech for? Someone in your political role?
Please.
You're welcome anytime to help out with the show. Believe me, we could use the help, Jason. But who's the political figure, or somebody? Maybe doesn't you don't have that sort of list?
You know, if you go back through history, people often ask what's the favorite speech? And it's actually, strangely, not a speech that was written. It's Robert F. Kennedy's speech in 1968 on the night that Martin Luther King Jr. was killed. Hmm. And the reason that I respect that speech, and I think that RFK would have been an interesting person to write for, is because of that lived history that he had of personal loss and also personal growth. And I think he brought all of that to that one moment in delivering that speech. And I think that's the kind of person you want in a leadership position who's experienced those things personally and become more wise, I think, as a result of them. And I think we hope, given the loss that Joe Biden has suffered, that, not to compare him to RFK, but maybe that he is somebody who can kind of take forward his own personal experiences and with a steady hand try to move us forward. I think that's our hope today.
Well said, Jason, and of course it is. You're a speechwriter. You know how to put things just right. Thank you so much for calling in today, Jason. I appreciate it.
All right, Anna. Great.
It's good hearing your voice. Jason DeSanto there. He's a political speechwriter, of course, and he's senior lecturer at Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. Okay, one not-so-important observation from the inauguration before we get to the real important stuff with political analyst Tom Serafin. Anyone else notice this? Lauren, Mary, jump in here. The fashions, okay?
Oh, yeah. Oh, of course.
Great fashions. I would say they looked good, but the monochromatic look. Everybody was dressed in this one color.
Well, it's like hard to find nice winter coats.
But they were all
very styled.
You don't want to wear a big yellow coat or, you know, middle of winter.
Your big puffy coat. Like you didn't see much of that. But Jill Biden was in all teal, right? You saw Michelle Obama in her, she had that just, that
it's like maroon.
Kind of
purple,
burgundy.
A maroon.
Yeah, maroon. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like just all in purple.
Kamala's purple coat.
Kamala,
and I looked it up,
purple.
And that's supposed to be a color of bipartisanship.
Yeah, purple. Red and blue.
Yeah.
That's what I thought. There was a lot of purple.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of
purple.
That was the message with the purple. Lady Gaga, of course, very understated. She wore neon red. She had that ginormous. Did you see the big brooch? The bird?
The dove? Yeah, it was
hard
like a dove. All gold.
all gold. And that was, do we know what the symbolism, you know, she's in a meat dress and that meant something, and so, now we're supposed to read this.
Oh,
peace,
so what,
I think it is.
Yeah,
peace.
Everybody says she looked like the Hunger Games. That's being totally, I've been seeing it all over social media, that it's like a Hunger Games, because they all, that big brooch, do you remember? In the Hunger Games?
I feel like other outfits she has worn would be more Hunger Games than that.
Yeah, but this, yeah, it was like that navy cashmere coat she had on. I don't know. That's what they're comparing it to anyway. But I like Jill Biden's outfit. You know, she had mm-hmm. that like tweed light blue coat that matched with the dress. It was really pretty.
Yeah,
mask,
it was
J-Lo. The mask even matched. Yeah.
All in white. Yeah. It's just one observation I made. Again, not an important one, just something that was there to be noticed. Let's talk to Tom Serafin about other things. Tom, I won't ask you to mention anything about the fashion. You don't have to weigh in on that at all, because you have very important observations, I'm sure, and I want to hear them about the inauguration and what you saw there. You're an astute political observer, and tell us, first of all, good afternoon, and tell us what you saw.
Yes, good afternoon. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I gotcha. We're good.
Good, good. You know, I nobody would ever accuse me of being the arbiter of fashion or popular culture, but Senator Amy Klobuchar did have a yellow jacket on.
I did see that.
On, and it was kind of bright and stunning, you know, with all the muted colors, as you say. I thought it was, you know, very attractive, but that's, you know, that's what I know, you know, which is whatever, you know.
Well, that's what stood out for you.
And you might get a cup of coffee with that knowledge.
What else did you notice, though? I mean, okay, there's a lot going on there, and this is a big moment for our nation, for the country, and we all sort of took away different things. And I know you look at this, and from where you sit, what did you see there? What's your impression?
Oh, I thought it was Senator Joe Biden, now President Joe Biden, was consistent to his theme that he's been around for a very, very long time. Senator for 48 years. I was in Iowa when he was running for president. I was working for Gary Hart at the time, and Dave Wilhelm was handling his campaign. And he was as kind and as gracious as he is today with everybody. I mean, what are you doing? How's it going? You know, what do you think? What are the polls telling you? You know, and he's still that same type of individual. So given the freedom to run his White House and his government the way he wishes, I think there's going to be a lot of conciliation, a lot of arm twisting in the Senate and the House, but he's capable of doing that because he has those relationships with Mitch McConnell, Steny Hoyer, and others, you know, that are going to be principal players for moving his legislation. He does have to appeal to the left in his party so that they are cooperating in the House. The House margins and the Senate margins are razor thin. But today, he put his arms around everybody in this country and said, we have to heal, we have to come together. And he went to the edge of referring to the insurrection and all these other situations to the people all the way on the right side. But, you know, he's got to appeal towards the middle, push people towards the middle, and I think he's willing to do that. I thought it was perfectly a Joe Biden speech. It was the right speech for the right day, for the right time. And, you know, he's to be commended for it.
You know, just the imagery of it, just watching it. I was watching on multiple channels at once, just trying to take in the way it was being covered. And you know, it's always magnificent to look at our nation's capital on a moment like this. And this today, we had the flags, not the people. And you had this theme of America United. But it was largely politicians we were looking at and not people. I always enjoy seeing the crowd shots. I understand why we don't have them, right? But it's you also saw those images. You had the federal troops out there, 25,000 federal and local troops. You had concrete barricades and razor wire and things like that to sort of just remind us that America's not united. And those images were also very powerful today, as powerful as the images of the unity and the flags and that kind of thing. And you think Biden, President Biden, did work hard to strike that tone, where he was reaching out to say, I will fight as hard for you if you didn't vote for me. And at the end of the day, it feels as if, you know, I was asking the speechwriter, Jason Santo, about this. How do you really bring those folks into the fold? What would be your advice politically now? Because as you move that rhetoric into action, what can he do? What should he do? What are the steps he should take?
Well, tonight he's going to start issuing executive orders the first press briefing with the new press secretary. It's at 6 o'clock this evening. He's coming on the heels of Donald Trump leaving this morning early from the White House lawn and going down to Florida. He's going to have to show that he's willing to reach out. The most important thing, I think, initially, is to say to the Senate and to the House leadership, we're not going to be doing any kind of impeachment trial. The business of the people is so much more important than making an effort that a lot of constitutional scholars will argue with you is not possible to put a trial of the next president on trial, when he's not around anymore. That should be taken up by, courts in New York or wherever else they want to chase him. But in reality, the Senate, the people's business needs to move on. We've got this COVID nightmare. We've got the recession. He's got a $1.9 trillion economic stimulus package he wants to pass. He's not going to make friends in either house in the opposition party where the margins are so razor thin by deciding, yes, let's go ahead with a trial that's going to consume 3 weeks of my new administration. Just not going to work.
I'm sorry, did I miss it? I never heard him say, let's not do the impeachment. Let's not move forward. I thought I heard that Joe Biden say we're going to be able to do both, continue with our agenda that helps the people while moving forward.
No, you're correct.
Forward.
You were asking me what he should be doing.
What he should be. Got it.
My attitude is, but no trial. I mean, I think the general public already knows and has a pretty good opinion about the ex-president. I don't know what he wins there. I don't know what he gains there politically. When he's got a real difficult agenda to pass, the first thing he's going to do tonight is stop the pipeline. He's going to lift the Muslim ban. He's going to tell people that the climate accord is going to be something he wants to rejoin. He's got an eviction moratorium he's going to extend for another month and a half. He's got to pass a stimulus package. The recession is so great now because of the pandemic, and those numbers will begin to kind of trickle out over the first quarter and into the second quarter of the year. The market is doing well today, a couple hundred points, but eventually it's going to show the distance between recovery and where we are today. He's got to get to that. And I think you see that in a lot of states where they're hoping to lift the ban on restaurants and other businesses. Our governor is suggesting we might be able to do that shortly. He's got to get to the business at hand rather than the politics of the aggrieved.
Speaking of the business at hand, Tom, we've got to pause for a moment here, but I do want to circle back on some of those things and drill down on them. I know he says he's going to start a federal mask mandate, that's in a play. There's a foreclosure moratorium that he announced. He's going to announce stop building the wall, halting that immediately, and some other things, too, immigration and climate change, moving forward with those immediately. Let's dig into some of those in just a moment here. Tom Serafin, political analyst, kind enough to spend some extra time with us here as we talk about this the inauguration today and the events in our nation's capital. Interesting, just to recap something you just said, you say if you were advising Joe Biden, our new president, what he should do moving forward if he truly wants to unify, you say call off the impeachment trial. Do not do that. Do not move forward with that.
Yes, I would absolutely agree. I think it's in contradiction to actually his inaugural speech of trying to reach out and bring people together. I think I would leave that to the lawyers in the Federal Office of Investigation for the United States Justice Department in New York and other places where they're currently got the ex-president under investigation. I think it slows down his momentum, and I think really, creates more of a momentum for the opposition, which is unnecessary. He's got to show that he can do something with the AOC crowd in the House of Representatives, the left. You've got to bring the left together. That margin is very thin. And I think the Keystone Pipeline, I think the Paris Accords, I think the eviction situation, even AOC said today that $1.9 trillion was not enough, but that's a big start for him, and some people want him to go further and not worry about building that deficit. The Muslim ban being lifted, I think, is a good idea. Stopping the wall, that's an issue that, that's going to have more of an impact 6 to 10 months down the road when situation changes along that border. So I think those are all good things for him. He's reaching out to his voters, especially to the voters on the left, to show that he's there, he's with them. But he's going to have to do some major legislating then on that $1.9 trillion support bill that he wants to get out of the Congress. And, you know, he's got a one-vote margin in the Senate. And Joe Manchin is a conservative Democrat. There are places for him to go if he needs some help. But he needs to be very strong on a nonpartisan basis, which was what the inauguration and his speech was all about, bringing people together. How do you do that at the same time you're impeaching a president that 74 million Americans voted for? And there are constitutional scholars then at the same time on a parallel basis arguing whether or not it's a legitimate process. Everything that's gone on about this whole thing for the last 40 years is about people feeling they've been illegitimized or disenfranchised from what goes on in D.C., and that as taxpayers, now they serve the bureaucratic empire of D.C. rather than the reverse. As taxpayers, we thought we had a government working for us, and now we're working for the government, and they see this process continue in D.C. I think it's unnecessary because he's already won. He's on top, the mountain. And those people that want revenge, take it up at another system, another venue, because my job is to legislate and make this country whole again. And I think with Joe Biden at the helm, he's got great relationships in the Senate and great relationships in the House, institutional relationships. He can put a deal together. Let me assure you, he can do that.
Yeah, you feel like if someone can, hopefully it is him, because the country needs that right now. I think you're right. How do you do that, though? How do you stand up for the people who did not vote for him in a country and divided, while you're also appealing to, and I think this will be one of the themes moving forward, what we're going to be constantly covering, appealing to the progressive left of the party, who is going to say, well, wait a minute, let's come over here. Let's be initiating this agenda, not playing in the middle, even though, you know, you promised that as a candidate, but just don't forget, you're a Democrat and we're part of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I actually believe he can do both. And I think he's quite capable of doing that based on his history in D.C. He can talk to both sides at the same time, and he might even get some people in the same room. It's much harder when you have an inter-party fight between two people in the same family versus having a family fight with the family across the street, a distinct different family. It's almost easier to come to terms with the family across the street than it is internally in your own kitchen. And that's his battles in his own kitchen. I'm confident he can handle the Republican Party if he does what he said he was going to do today. My concern for him would be, as you say, the progressive left, to give them much of what they're looking for and show them the path as they go forward. Building greater coalitions, I think, is something he needs to help them with. But at the same time, he's got to bring the other side into the kitchen as well. And I think he's very capable of doing that with the Republican Party.
You know, one of the things that was successful for him on the campaign trail was to run against President Trump rather than necessarily run for his own agenda, I felt, at least. And now Trump is not in the equation, so do you continue to reference Trump, or does that not play well anymore? Or what would you say from a political strategy standpoint? Is that the right way to go?
Well, remember, he was vice president for 8 years with Barack Obama, and Barack Obama, even in the eighth year of his incumbency presidency, was blaming George Bush for things he inherited. He used the term inherited more than any other president. That was an amazing term he used. And Rahm Emanuel, who was his chief of staff, used it three times when he was in office, but several years into the mayorship, because he didn't want to ruffle any feathers with Mayor Daley. So in this particular case, I inherited this. I think you'll see a lot of that from Joe Biden pointing the finger when it's necessary politically, but he understands that the people that are running the Senate and the Republican Party in the House and the Republican Party in the Senate, most of those people are very mainstream. They come from his country clubs. They come from his restaurants. They come from his social gathering in D.C. for 40, 50 years. So he's got a very good ability to communicate with them. It's the people on the fringes in his party that he has to bring back into the kitchen. And I wouldn't worry about the right. He can always say, you know, I inherited this problem or that problem and make an effort, but just don't brand them anymore. They don't want to be branded. And that's just politics. You don't have to do that unless you're in a real tussle and a real battle. He's not there in a battle right now. So it was smart politics to allow Donald Trump to implode on the campaign trail. You're absolutely correct. But now he's going to be running his own agenda. He's got to lay it out there, and he's got to make a good case for it. And today I thought he really did.
Yeah. You said don't go forward with an impeachment. That would be your advice, but that the Trump family still has a number of legal challenges ahead. Been very widely covered. But today, I don't know if you saw this, there was one more pardon with just an hour to go. President Trump, in his final hour, pardoned Jeanine Pirro's ex-husband, you know, the Fox News host, her ex,
right.
Albert Pirro. Did you see that? I guess he used to represent the president or something, tax fraud, something. He was apparently he's been pardoned.
Right. You know, that's the pleasure of the president. He can pardon anybody. It's been something that many presidents have done. Actually, I think he pardoned 143 or maybe 144, yeah. 73 pardons and 70 commutations. Mm-hmm. And in the body of that, you know, Bill Clinton actually had more, and he and the president, President Obama, were about the same. But, you know, that's what presidents do as they're on their way out. You can find fault with a lot of folks that have been pardoned. You know, remember the outcry, Mr. President Biden pardoning a guy by the name of Rich, whose president was, whose lawyer was Eric Holder, who, you know, turned out to be the attorney general for Barack Obama. So everybody in Washington is connected. It makes no difference whether you're Republican or Democrat. If you've been around there 20, 25 years, everybody knows everybody, and everybody knows where everybody hangs out, and they all mm-hmm. talk. And then they go on center stage here with in front of MSNBC, CNN, Fox, and everything else, and they play their roles. But don't kid you. This guy is a creature of D.C. He understands how it works. He can make it work. He just needs to have time to do that. And the left, Nancy Pelosi, has to really do a good job in the House to take care of the progressive left. And the people in the Senate, if they go after the filibuster, all hell's going to break out there, and that makes his agenda so much more difficult than the past. You've got to keep some peace for 6 months, get some wind through your back, and then let them do what they want to do. But get entrenched. I mean, you know, get a foothold. You know, make things happen. You know, I Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi are key ingredients to make this work for President Biden. They're capable of doing it, but the president's got to tell them, you know, lay low here for 6 months. Keep your people, you know, together. And yeah, we'll see what we can do for 6 months. I'll have so much wind in my sails. We can do anything for the next 3 years. But don't get in my way right now.
Thank you, Tom. I love getting your perspective on politics and fashion, too. If you ever have fashion thoughts, please call in.
Don't tell
please
my call wife.
In. I know your wife is very fashionable. Thank you, Tom, for the time this afternoon. 574, Amanda Gorman was also wearing yellow. We're trying to remember, was anybody wearing bright colors? Amanda Gordon. And maybe the reason that I didn't even notice that is because she stood out. We have to talk about her for her powerful words and her powerful story as well. I know Ryan Burrow has been tracking things from the newsroom, anchoring some of our coverage today. You no doubt noticed what she had to say, maybe not what she wore, but it's she certainly stood out as one of the powerful moments.
Yeah, today, she's getting a lot of social media traction right now, which is really cool. And I was reading, actually, don't you know, cut me out on the fashion sense here.
Okay.
I did.
All right, let's hear it.
I did hear that she had a birdcage ring that was given to her by Oprah.
Okay, it's all making sense now. Oprah Winfrey just tweeted, "I've never been prouder to see another young woman rise. Brava, Amanda Gorman."
Yeah.
Maya Angelou is cheering, and so am I. How about that? And a woman with a backstory of having been a stutterer herself, afraid to present her poems. And so it just, there's a lot there.
The poem world doesn't get as much credit in the United States as you'd think, right? I mean, every 4 years we might find out who the big poet is. It's not something, you know, we watch sports and we watch celebrities, but the poet world never quite rises up to that level, does it?
Yeah. I wore a ring with a caged bird, as you point out, a gift from Oprah for the occasion to symbolize Maya Angelou, a previous inaugural poet. So the caged bird. It's interesting. It's, it was one of the moments, I think, with bipartisan support when she came up there, and she's a rising star, to say the least. I don't know how old she is. She doesn't look barely
22.
35. She, how old is she?
22.
She's 22.
What were you doing at 22?
Oh, my God. College. I'm so glad there was no social media then, because I don't know. It's oh, my gosh. You just think of the things you were doing at that age, right, Ryan? And
yeah.
How inconsequential they were.
I'm trying not to think of the things I was doing at 22.
Yeah, I just, I think, yeah, I was still in college. So I, you know, I don't know. That was a big moment. What else stands out for you now that you've had a chance to sort of?
You know, it's interesting because we're going through the process now. And for those people who, you know, tuned in and heard the swearing in and then the speech and then kind of tuned out, there's a lot more going on today. There's more pomp and circumstance. There was the, gifting, that they saw a lot of, both President Biden and Vice President Harris received gifts from various people that was done at the Capitol. That's not usually the traditional way they do that, but obviously with things being the way they are with the pandemic, we saw the president and former presidents all went to Arlington National Cemetery. There was a wreath laying ceremony, and now the virtual parade is about to get underway here. And obviously, we're used to seeing them, you know, march from the U.S. Capitol to the White House. And I don't know if you've been a part of any inaugurations before. I've been to one before, and you know, it's a big long parade. It's a celebration. People hanging out of windows, and you know, it's a historic event. You know, sometimes there are some security issues, and you know, you see the president have to go inside of the car for a little while and then come out. But usually, those last few blocks, they're able to come out and wave and get that photo op and go into the White House. And we're going to see something similar to that. Obviously, the parade's going to be virtual, but they will both Kamala Harris and Joe Biden will be getting out of the limousine about a block or two from the White House to have that photo op before going in. And they got more hands to shake and fists to bump, I guess.
Are you allowed to do that?
Bump. You know, then, and actually, Joe Biden's going to get to some executive orders that he's going to sign. So there is some business to be done today.
Yeah, it's interesting how quickly and briskly he's getting to that business and the executive orders. It doesn't seem like that's sort of the thing we've seen in the past. He made a point that he wants to undo some of the things President Trump did.
And said that he will be making some bold moves, and almost alluding to, he said bold moves for the American family. So are we talking stimulus? Are we talking, I know John floated the idea of perhaps this being maybe some movement on student loans, but it sounds as though he's got something, and we'll figure out what it is coming up.
Speak to a little bit of this, the security, because I know a ton of it in Washington, but we've shut down some buildings here and in Springfield and beefed up security around different places in advance of today. Doesn't seem as if anything has happened or that there are any credible threats of that I heard, but I'd love to get your perspective on what we're seeing there.
The only day in this business where we can say no news is good news, right? I mean, we're usually itching for that storyline, and we haven't seen it. I think, Lauren, if you're listening right now, I believe there were just a handful of protesters outside of some of these Capitol buildings across the country.
I believe they said that the most crowded was Michigan and Ohio, where there were about a dozen. Some areas in, I think, California it was, there was just one lone protester. I think that was the case somewhere else as well. So really not much in terms of anything dangerous to report.
Governor Pritzker had prepared more than 200 National Guardsmen in Springfield for any kind of incident or unrest that would happen. It doesn't sound like we've heard anything about that. And really, in Washington, D.C., we didn't get this flooding of protesters and demonstrations. There were two pens in which people were allowed to demonstrate fairly a few blocks away, far away from the inauguration site, but we didn't hear about any unrest, any unfortunate circumstances, so everything seems pretty calm to this point.
You know, it's interesting because we had travel expert Peter Greenberg on yesterday, and I didn't even realize he was heading to D.C. He was leaving Mexico. He talked about that, but he's going to D.C.
Leaving
for
Mexico
the inauguration.
For D.C. in January?
Yeah, I mean, he's a travel guy. So yeah, I don't know what he's doing. He doesn't always make sense, but I love his advice. And he said that he was, when he landed in D.C., he was checked something like three or four times, not only his ID, his boarding pass, asking questions. The TSA was very vigilant about letting anyone pass through there. I know Airbnb canceled your ability to book a room there, so there were very few places to stay. They were
I mean, geez, the security, the security was really, really, really almost on lockdown, you would say, in D.C.
And Washington, D.C. is a city that's known for that. You know, any moment that you're walking down a street of Washington, D.C., you have to fully be prepared that a road would shut down because congressmen and women and senators have to go rush for a vote. They're allowed to run red lights there. There are opportunities. One time I was stopped on a sidewalk by Secret Service because it turns out Bill Clinton was eating in the restaurant. And
oh my gosh.
They literally stopped us. We had no idea why, and then we eventually saw. So, I mean, security is nothing new there in Washington, D.C. And you know, it's interesting because people feel secure seeing that, you know, seeing those National Guard members with the long guns. For other people, it makes them kind of jumpy and kind of nervous as well. So,
right.
You know, you don't really know how people are going to respond to that.
Kind of like the cop cars, the flashing lights on Michigan Avenue. I've heard people say, yeah, I like to know their presence. I like to know they're there. My view is I don't like seeing that. It makes it feel as if something's happening at every point in time, that there's a police scene on every corner. Maybe that has to do with my background having covered crime for so many years, that when I see the flashing lights, I think crime scene, or maybe not. I don't know. It just can have both sort of reactions to in different people.
Yeah, you see a canine sniffing around some cars or a bus, and you think to yourself, oh, that's good. My bus is safe. But then you think, wait a minute, why are they doing that?
Why are they doing
that?
Yeah. There might be something here that I need to... Right, that's it. There's the second part of it. And I know City Hall was shut down, and Thompson Center, I believe, today, too. Illinois Capitol, I think they closed down. It just seemed like they were sort of just taking every precaution, even though, you know, nothing really happened.
Yeah, it's not a ton of news coming out of the local today so far. Knock on wood. Hopefully today's nice and calm, and then we can get back to wrangling about city council members and
everything else.
Getting vaccines in people's arms tomorrow.
Right, and that will happen. And you did a great job today, Ryan.
Thank you.
Thanks for hopping on with me. Appreciate it. Let's talk to right now. We're going to talk about the inauguration, and Dean Reynolds from News Nation. He's their chief political correspondent, is jumping in here. Busy day for you, Dean. We appreciate the time.
Hi, Anna. How are you?
You know, I think I'm good. You know, I've been watching things from afar, and you've been there, and interested in seeing now that things are, they're still going on, but the bulk of the events have sort of passed. What are your thoughts? What can you tell us?
Well, I'm keenly interested in what Donald Trump wrote in his note to the incoming president. You have any guesses on what he might have said to him?
I'm fascinated by that, too. My guess is it was curt. Does he reference him by name? He didn't do that in his farewell address. He just said the incoming administration or the next administration. Wondering what you write there, huh?
Well, and he also said he'd be back in some form, which will excite a lot of his followers and nauseate people who didn't particularly like him. But as for the overall ceremony, you know, I said on the air earlier that we should not make the ordinary extraordinary. In other words, what we saw today was the way inaugurations past have gone. And so was the message of unity that the new president tried to send to the rest of the country. That seems, after 4 years of divisiveness, kind of extraordinary, but it really isn't. It's just sort of the common thing that you see. There's a common thread calling for unity, you know, roll up our sleeves and all that stuff in inauguration after inauguration, and then it kind of came to a screeching halt with American carnage.
Right. I'm watching right now Vice President Harris walk up the stairs with her husband as she enters the White House. The arrival, I think the parade portion is sort of wrapping up right now. Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, they can rest a little bit maybe, and then there won't be any balls tonight, you know, the big formal inaugural balls, but there will be some kind of entertainment that will be broadcast on the networks. And then this very sort of strange inaugural will fade into history. I mean, the message is traditional, but the actual inaugural itself was far from it. I mean, you know, start with the fact that it was an armed camp, and no real audience. Although I kind of wondered if that's actually the biggest audience that Joe Biden has spoken to in months. Because, you know, he did most of his campaign rallies with these cars parked in lots honking their horns instead of applauding. So we'll see.
Well, you know, that's an important point, and I do want to ask you about that, because he didn't run the kind of campaign that Donald Trump ran, for sure. He didn't hold big rallies, that's number one. But he also wasn't entirely available, and maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, to the press, to interviews. He was sort of selective in that way. And I wonder, as president, are you going to do that? Can you do that? Can you call on specific reporters and not others and, you know, kind of block them out? Give one thing to President Trump. He'd call on everybody, and he took a lot of heat. He would continually, you know, call on people and be accessible in press briefings.
Right. And I don't think it helped him a lot, because it may have initially, but then it looked like he was in sort of a duel with reporters. And, you know, again, his followers like the put downs and, you know, you don't know what you're talking about, or why don't you sit down, or, you know, that kind of stuff. But the general public got tired of it. And then you saw in the springtime, he just sort of stopped becoming available at those briefings for the coronavirus. You know, every president has their own style. Democrats have generally been, I think, more available to reporters than Republicans. But, you know, again, the question comes back to you, was Donald Trump a Republican, or was Donald Trump just kind of a one-off abnormality in the political system, you know, who broke all the rules or did things differently than Republican predecessors and Democratic predecessors? So as it relates to Biden, I would imagine he'll be conventionally available to reporters like other presidents before him. He probably won't have much of a honeymoon because of the pandemic. You know, people will become impatient right away if there is some sign that he, too, is unable to get this thing under control. You know, his own people are saying now maybe 500,000 dead by the middle of next month. You know, people, voters, Democrats, to say nothing of Republicans, are going to want to see some results. And what he said today is the only way we get results is if we work together. And I think that may resonate with people.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's interesting. It's just history being made. And I just wonder, anything that you've observed, having been in politics for a long time, that stands out for you today?
Well, you know, I just kept thinking about how long Biden has been trying to get to this point. You know, I mean, I was a young reporter with United Press International back in 1973 when this young whippersnapper named Joe Biden came into the Senate at the age of 30 or something. And I've watched him, you know, grow into his current self. And was very doubtful that a man of 78 years could withstand the rigors of the presidency. And I'm still a little skeptical, because it is a hell of a tough job.
Normal times.
And yeah, without the pandemic, without the civil discord, without the cratering economy, you know, I, you know, we all wish him well, and I'm just watching him today and keeping an eye on a couple of things. You know, his ambition to get to where he was, you know, it was unflagging, and also the things that he's overcome in his life, the tragedies with his wife and his daughter and then his son, Bo. And, you know, resiliency is the word that pops into my head when I see what's going on today.
Yeah, it's more to come, and you've been doing a great job covering things for News Nation. So thank you for taking time out for us on this busy day.
You're welcome.
Gee, so many people commenting on Amanda Gorman being one of the moments of the inauguration today. Just a breathtaking poem, something that resonated. 22 years old she is. Following the footsteps of Maya Angelou, Robert Frost, Amanda Gorman wrote her way into history with her performance today. Unlike Frost, who was 86 when he became the first poet to speak at the presidential inauguration in 1961, or Maya Angelou, she was 64. Gorman's just 22 years old. Joe Khalil is with News Nation. He is the D.C. correspondent, and you were out there today. What did it feel like to be out there for that moment? Thanks for coming on the show.
It's really amazing.
Hey, Joe.
Can I describe? Yes.
Okay, we got you now. I was having a problem with your audio.
Can you hear me?
We hear you. Yeah, we got you.
Oh, sorry. Thank you for having me on. That moment was really amazing. You know, I remember distinctly as people came up to speak, including President Joe Biden. I was always looking at the audience, which was a limited one today for obvious reasons. It was mostly members of the U.S. House and senators. So you have a lot of, public speakers in that group, right? And some people would go up, and you can see there were some heads that would dip into the cell phones, and there were people kind of looking around and talking every once in a while. But that 22-year-old, when Amanda got up there and delivered that poem, I every single face that I saw was glued to her. They were fixated on what she was saying. And I wasn't surprised afterwards that, on Twitter she started to really blow up and get a lot of attention. It's one thing for her age group, someone to be able to deliver a beautifully well-written poem the way she did, but to do it in front of the likes of, three former presidents sitting on stage and, Barack Obama and, others who are known to be orators, it was really impressive.
And to have had a speech impediment as a child and not feel comfortable sort of presenting her work, even though she's got oozing with talent and just bursting with things to say such a young age, right?
So great. And it sort of, in a way, reflects Joe Biden's story, who grew up with a stutter and had to literally teach himself to talk his way out of that stutter. And it was actually the Biden family who identified her and who requested that she give that poem at the end of this inauguration ceremony. So it really was nice to hear from her.
Any other things you just want to, I know you're just joining us for a couple minutes here. It's a busy day over at News Nation. Anything you want to just sort of end on here, something that stands out for you other than Gorman, Amanda Gorman?
The thing that I noticed was you could really tell, you hear about it, but that fraternity of former presidents is very real. I was distinctly trying to find out on stage, see how they interacted with each other. George W. Bush, Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Joe Biden, all, they were all very cordial with each other. The families all greeted each other nicely, and it was really nice to see. I know that today we had an unprecedented situation, unprecedented for recent times, where President Trump, refused to be there today. Mike Pence represented the administration, and, all of the former presidents did acknowledge, Vice President Pence. But I thought that was striking, that they put their politics aside, they're from different parties. But Laura Bush and George W. Bush, go around and give big hugs to the former Democrat presidents. And, it's something special to see because that doesn't happen often. It's basically, only big name funerals and and these events where you see them all together. So that was nice to see.
It was, and more of that for the future. I think all of us would like to see that. Joe Khalil, thank you for the time. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling in.
Of course, glad to be with you.
Washington D.C. correspondent Joe Khalil there. Hey, I think we have a few minutes here just to get Eric Rung. Been trying to get you. I know you have been swamped with the coverage over at Channel 9 throughout the day, and so I just wanted to say, hey, thank you for calling in. And what's it like? What's it like being out there?
Well, we are pretty much been on the outside of the perimeter of the Capitol for the past day and a half here, ever since we got into Washington, D.C. It has been an unbelievable experience, mostly just because it's so eerie last night compared to today. Last night you're seeing hundreds and hundreds of troops, National Guard members walking around the city in formation with rifles, with sidearms. It's just not a sight that, you know, you see on American streets. Today, early this morning, we found out where the Illinois National Guard, the 300 or so that are in D.C. to help with this mission here, were stationed, which was about a mile from the Capitol. Went over there, talked with some of them. It was really interesting. All of them, very friendly, interacting with a lot of the people in the neighborhood in that park. Yet, just on the ground in front of them are riot shields and their helmets and other protective gear. So, interesting juxtaposition there of what we've been seeing. But I will say, this show of force, 25,000 National Guard members, thousands of law enforcement officers, not only around the Capitol, but around the entire District of Columbia here, it has been extremely peaceful. There's been a couple of protests here and there that have popped up. Nothing of a really large scale by any means. No arrests, things like that. Things that people really feared. The reason why there is such a force here today, but it was very peaceful. And now, as this inauguration day starts to wind down, the streets again here in D.C. are once again very quiet. A few people coming out, taking a look, snapping some pictures outside of the Capitol as far as you can walk, which is still in some parts you can't even see the Capitol because they are keeping everybody so far back. But, there's people walking around. And the other interesting thing I definitely want to mention is people are going up to the National Guard when they pass them on the street or the U.S. Capitol Police or just law enforcement in general, and they say thank you. Thank you for being here. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for protecting our city. And I'm going to leave you with one quick little story here. There was a 4.5-year-old boy, and I have to make sure I say 4.5 because he made sure to tell me that. He had baked some cookies.
Okay.
And he walked as far as he could to the last checkpoint before he could get to the Capitol. And he walked up to the National Guard members on the other side of the fence. He said, "I baked these cookies for you. I want to say thank you for protecting my neighborhood."
Oh.
And
what a beautiful thing.
The guard members were fantastic. They gave him an American flag patch. And, it's stories like that, despite what we're seeing and all the news that we're hearing and all of that, which brought us where we are here today, it's stories like that that make me and hopefully others a little hopeful for what's to come.
No, there's no doubt. There's no question. Moments like that, they really do. They help us move to that position of hope and that we can come together in the future. And I know you'll be covering all that. And is this the first time you've covered one of these, Eric?
This is my first inauguration, yes. Yeah. It's a memorable one, that's for sure.
I bet. Gosh, I was just going to say, can you compare it to anything? But I don't think you could anyway, even if you had been to every single one of them. This is no doubt different. Eric, thank you. Thanks for calling in, okay? Be well.
You got it. Have a great day.
I want to talk to Laura Schwartz, talk about the feeling of being there at an inauguration, part of the incoming administration. Laura's a Chicagoan, Wisconsin native. And I know you've been covering overseas a lot of what's going on here in America with our inauguration and explaining it to all them. You were head of White House events under Clinton, so it's not the same as we are today. 2021 is a very different time, but you certainly have witnessed this moment in time, Laura. So thanks for calling in.
Well, it's my pleasure, Anna. It's something that we can all witness. I mean, today the world is watching, as well as all of us here at home. And, I think back to being a 19-year-old college student at the American University, bright-eyed, getting tickets from a member of Congress, standing on that cold National Mall and watching it take place. And then in 96, with President Clinton on the dais of the west front of the Capitol looking out. And, it's this pivotal moment. But I have to say, whether that was all those years ago when there was a crowded mall, or Obama with a million people, or today with flags lining the mall and just members of Congress plus one, we all got to see democracy in action. We all can realize that whoever's taking oath can feel that it's bigger than themselves. And that's what today's about. And I think it successfully went off.
Yeah, you know, so I wonder, if you're part of the incoming administration, which you were, do you go straight to work today? Are you, do you get a little desk and a cubicle and it's go, go, go?
Oh,
I mean, how does this happen?
It is go, 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 find my office, get your government-issued cell phone and your email address and start setting things up. While the president was being sworn in at the Capitol, as soon as noon occurs, that is when, not a minute before, that the White House staffers working for the Biden administration get to go in the West Wing. It's sort of like supermarket sweep. You get in there and you get all of your, you get all of your items. You find your office and you start, you know, assembling, especially the press operation itself. But that is something that starts to occur right away. The press secretary is going to give a briefing this afternoon. The staff secretary that takes care of all the records and the papers has already gotten the executive orders together and put them in the Oval Office, for which Joe Biden is signing right now, in fact. But then while all those staffers are getting into the West Wing starting at noon on Inauguration Day, a few hours earlier, when the Trumps left, the last moving truck departed the lawn, and arriving in is everything for the Bidens. And about 90 people behind the scenes, these are from the White House Usher's office. They are operations guys. They are engineers. They are butlers. You name it. All hands on deck. They're not only doing a deep clean with an outside cleaning company, but basically they move in furniture. Some of these pieces might be the Biden's own furniture or taken from the White House collection. They put their favorite food in the fridge. Their clothes are going to be in the closet when they walk into the White House. They even have personal family photos and artifacts around. So there's a lot that goes in to getting the family settled as well as the administration.
You know, I have to say, I've been on the air now a couple hours, and I've the monitors up and around me here, looking, kind of monitoring events, and I, mm-hmm. I paused for a moment to see Kamala Harris walk up the steps to enter the White House, and it just felt like a moment, but it is a significant moment, I think, worthy of reflecting on. I talked to my 9-year-old before she started school this morning, and she said she wanted to see this. She wanted to see them go in. She never witnessed it, really. I think she doesn't really pay attention to it and maybe doesn't understand the full magnitude of the moment, but she'll grow up never knowing a time when there wasn't a woman in that role. It'll just seem normal to her. And I think no matter what your politics and whether you supported Kamala or you don't particularly like her politics, I think this moment deserves note. And, you know,
I agree. No, you're absolutely right, Anna. And like you said, it's not just, you know, Democrats. It's all women. It's these little girls that will never know different. It's these other girls that now see somebody that looks like them with the color of their skin or their background or just the fact that she's a girl, too. And then it's also adult women across the country and grandparents and our elders who say, you know what? We've been fighting for this ever since we fought for the right to vote and the right for this and the right for that. So it really is this culmination. And today, I don't know about you, Anna, but I'm wearing my pearls. Have you heard about the pearl movement?
No. I haven't. No.
So get
Tell
this.
Us.
Kamala wore, so she wore pearls when she took the oath of office to be the state's attorney general of California. She wore pearls when she came into the Senate, when she was in the Judiciary Committee, grilling Attorney General Barr in that famous hearing a few years ago. And she, of course, wore pearls again today, just as she did when she debated Mike Pence. So there's been this pearl movement as a form of, you know, a symbol of power and leadership. So a lot of women around the country today have been wearing their pearls. I've got Republican women friends, just as like as my Democratic friends, wearing pearls today. And the other thing they're wearing, and this is a new trend, and I think it's pretty cool. I don't have my pair yet, but I want to get a pair of Chuck Taylors.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen
She's
her wear Chuck
those.
Taylor? I mean, it's pretty awesome.
She's on the cover of Vogue, if I'm not mistaken,
Chuck
in
Taylor's
her Chuck Taylors.
Yeah, you know, that was a controversy. Did you hear about
right.
that?
that she didn't want that picture. She wanted a more, you know, dignified, I don't know what you call it. They wanted a more formal picture for the cover.
A little bit more a little bit more official. Yeah, the staff wasn't too psyched about it, but you know, the staff didn't ask for photo approval. So then Anna Wintour, you know, heard about the controversy that they weren't all that happy with it. So they made the cover of the digital edition different online, showing a beautiful, you know, much more official photograph than sort of the casual one they put on the cover.
Yeah. I just finally here, I follow you, you on social media, and you are trying to communicate and explain to folks all around the world, BBC, Australian, Today Show, stuff like that, about what's going on here in America. And it's always hard to do that. So I don't envy that position. I can only imagine. I go, well, this is what we do here.
It's, you know, they're following along really closely, Anna. I mean, we live on the backdrop of a globally interdependent world. We're all living this pandemic together. Our national security affects other countries, economies, and so forth. That I really believe the world feels invested in what America does. And right now, what viewers of everything from the UK and Australia are telling me is that they feel like there's this relief, that there's this competency back, that there's a partner in America back. And so it's been very heartening. It's been very positive. And they're just tuning in as much as we are.
Yeah. President Trump, known for being nationalistic. A lot of people liked him because of that, but certainly this, the rest of the world would not necessarily be as excited about that kind of thing as they would be potentially about Joe Biden. So interesting stuff. Always interesting to talk to you too, Laura. And thank you. Thank you for calling into WGN this afternoon.
Hey, I appreciate it. Go grab your pearls.